Okay, so let's go ahead and think about some of the aspects of Hebrew poetry. And let's begin by going ahead and looking at parallelism. On the one hand, we've just noted that parallelism isn't the sum total of Hebrew poetry, but it is a common aspect of Hebrew poetry, and so it is something to think about. But even with parallelism, there's not necessarily a singular point of parallelism. The primary thing is the idea of repetition, saying a couple of different lines, sometimes more than one, more than two lines, but that are kind of repeating the same thing, but doing it in a slightly different language, usually to drive home a point. So it's saying things that are very similar in order to emphasize the point. So let's go to the very first verse of the Psalms, Psalm 1:1. And we see a little bit of repetition here. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scoffers. Now, this is actually three lines, not just two, but they're all parallel. They're all basically saying the same thing. Don't spend all your time with the ungodly. And it's doing it in different ways. In one, it's standing in the way or sitting in the seat or receiving counsel. But they're all parallel, just kind of repeating the same general idea in three different ways to drive home the point. And so you'll see this throughout the Psalms, or throughout Hebrew poetry, this idea of parallel lines complementing each other, repeating a general idea, is probably one of the most frequently seen things you'll see demarcating poetry in the scripture. Now, parallelism goes, on the one hand, most of the time we see it, it is repeating, but it also at times is contrast. Even here in Psalms 1, we see parallelism in which there is contrast. In verse 6, it says, "For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish." So here is a parallel statements, but they are contrasting statements. So the first one is focusing on the positive for the righteous, and then the second line on the way of the wicked will perish, the negative for the wicked. So it is two lines, still parallel in what they are saying. They're trying to emphasize a similar point, but they're doing that point by contrasting with one another rather than repeating the same idea. And so we see parallelism in both repetition and contrast. Now, if you want to dig in deeper, there is some other types of contrast or parallelisms that we can see. They're a little bit more rare, and so we're not going to spend a lot of time on them. I've got other things I want to spend on, but if you get a book on Hebrew poetry, you'll see there's two or three other types of parallelisms, but these are the primary ones that we see most of the time. The repetition is the most common. Contrast is somewhat frequent, as we see it even both of them in the same chapter right at the beginning of Psalm, the book of Psalms. But these are both things to look for. Now, again, as we come to these, so how do we interpret these? That's because the purpose of this is not just to identify the different types, but how do we interpret them? Well, we look at these and think of them along the lines of because they are parallel, the point is they're trying to make a point between the two of them. If I'm preaching as we get ready to go through this book, you won't see me spend a lot of time looking at one of these series of parallels and taking each one of them individually, because they're not intended to be taken individually. They are intended to be taken together, and they are driving home a central point that is informed by the way in which the two things are said, but they're not independent clauses to be analyzed independently. They complement each other, and the thing we want to learn from it is how they come together. What is the point? Now, again, we can look at them somewhat separately as we inform that general idea, but we want to be careful that we don't just, the way we would prose, in prose we go through and we tend to take each line by itself, analyze that line, and then move to the next line. But in parallelism of poetry, we take the two lines or three lines together and look at either the point they're trying to make as they repeat or the point they try to make in contrast. Okay, any questions about parallelism before we move on? Now, again, probably most of you here are familiar with the idea of parallelism. If you ask most people that know anything about Hebrew poetry, if you've heard of Hebrew poetry, parallelism is the first thing that'll come to mind. because it's what everybody seems to know. But there is a lot more to it than that that we want to look at this morning. But any questions or comments over parallelism?
How is it written out in the Hebrew? Do they write it so that it's obviously parallelism, or is it just strung together?
No, it is strung together. I mean, our demarcation in our English text to really set it apart is not in the Hebrew. At the same time, just the overall structure of the language is such that for those that are really good with Hebrew, I'm not really good with Hebrew, but they can pick up on it. Now, again, if you pick up a copy of the BHS, the Hebrew copy that most of us use today, it's set apart in there. You can tell the difference. But if you go back and look at actual, pick up a copy of the Dead Sea Scrolls, you're not going to see poetry set apart in there. Those are things that the assemblers of those things do to help the translation. But that's just not the way they wrote. Yes?
So it wasn't written? It was written.
No, and one thing to keep in mind, how are they writing most of this down? The early days. Were clay tablets and pressing things in. And even after they started writing on parchment, not parchment, but skins, you're still limited. You're not going to sit there and I remember. Have any of you ever seen? I know my dad has. Some of you others may have seen one of Jonathan Edwards' sermons. Has anybody seen a copy of his sermons written out? Think about for a moment for one of our things. Well, let's take a look at the bulletin we have right here. Okay, pick it up. We've got everything set apart, and we have all kinds of empty space, and you open it up and we've got different things, blocks set off, and we have margins, and we have all this empty space. One of the fascinating things that saw in Jonathan Edwards' sermons, and he's not the only one, but it's one of the ones that I've seen, is he would write out his entire sermon on hardly a sheet of paper, using little tiny, that almost too tiny to read print. And he would go from edge of the page to edge of the page, top of the page to the bottom of the page. No margins, just squeezing everything together. Running everything together, no lines between paragraphs. Just writing everything out. Why did he do that?
Paper,
yeah. I mean, he was doing it on any scrap of paper he could find, because paper was rare. And we have to think of the same thing in that era. You know, they didn't have all the resources that we have to be able they were very very conservationist, so to speak, trying to keep everything together. And so no, there was no setting apart. It just everything ran together. A lot of the paragraph breaks and things like that we have, you won't see much of in the actual Hebrew. The words tended to run together without breaks in between them, and you just have to know the declensions, and so you know when the one word ends, the another one begins, but when that space is put in between them, and all kinds of fun. So that's part of the fun of learning Hebrew. Although, again, most of us learning Hebrew today, we're not learning it like that. We're learning it after it's been taken by people that have assembled the manuscripts, printed them out, separated the words, separated the lines, demarcated the poetry, and then we do it. So. Anything else? Okay, let's go ahead and think about some of the other aspects. Imagery is another big thing in poetry. Now, this kind of flows along with some of the things we've been looking at lately with a lot of analogies and allegories and things like that. But poetry is full of that. Staying in Psalm 1, we see imagery. Verse 3, he is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf also does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. And this isn't really necessarily parallelism. This is more focusing on imagery, using imagery as of streams of water, trees by streams, leaves, etc., all giving imageries in order to describe the point they're trying to make, and that is that the person who follows the Lord is stable. He doesn't fade away. He prospers in the Lord. And so you'll see that a lot in poetry, and is this idea, just this flowery language, we might call it, just in this image, using broad imagery to describe things. Another important thing, especially in the Psalms, and I don't have any examples of it up here, other than I'll give a couple just off my head, but that's hyperbolic language. In other words, using extreme language in order to drive home a point. But let me ask you, what would be maybe some examples of this that you could think of in the Psalms especially? The imprecatory Psalms? Yeah, exactly. What are some specific examples? What's some specific language in imprecatory Psalms we might think is hyperbole?
Psalm 137,
dash the kids' heads. Yeah, you dash the kids' heads against the rocks. That's probably not intended to be taken hyper-literally. Probably more hyperbole, demonstrating a point. And that's an important thing to think about as we go through, and we'll see some of this extreme language in Scripture, especially in the imprecatory Psalms and things like that. We need to get hold of the point that's being made, recognizing that in poetry often there is hyperbole used that is a little bit more extreme than what we might see elsewhere in Scripture. And so that's something to keep in mind. Any questions about that? I don't intend to spend a lot of time on hyperbole. It is there. It's something to be aware of. It's important because, again, we want to be careful, you know, smashing babies' heads against rocks, smashing teeth out against rocks, variety of language like that throughout the Old Testament, especially in the Psalms. But we need to keep in mind the point that is being made by them. Another important issue is word plays. Now, word plays are often difficult for us to pick up in English, and it's often more important. This is where we really need to sometimes get a hold of what the Hebrew words are, because often the English words don't have the same effect that the Hebrew words underlying it do. There's a couple of different primary types of word plays. The first is similar sounding words. So what you'll see occasionally in the Hebrew is there will use a word that sounds similar to another word in order to basically just do a little play. So and this is something that's hard to illustrate in the English because the English is not translating, you know, the English equivalents aren't the Hebrew words, so it's hard to illustrate exactly. But the point is at times in the Hebrew authors will use words where one word sounds like another one, and in order to, and so it fits the poem, but it drives home a different point. And so that can be tricky at times. The more commonly what you'll see in Hebrew poetry, and Hebrew poetry loves to use words with double meanings. So on the one hand, as we emphasized a couple of weeks ago, when we're dealing with prose, one of the biggest mistakes we can make is to what we call illegitimate totality transfer. Take all the possible meanings of a word and dump it into this word and say, here's, you know, it means all of these things. Except when you're in poetry. And then often that's actually done very intentionally. Now, it's not trying to dump all the possible range of meaning into this word. But often in poetry, you'll find places, and you do it in prose as well, in places. But you can tell where they're doing this. But they'll take a word that has a double meaning, and they will intend both meanings of that word in it. And it's a word play that is done. It's found sometimes in prose. It's found an awful lot in poetry. It's especially found in the prophets. You see this type of double meaning. The prophets, especially a couple of them, just love to do word plays with double meanings of words. And again, that's one of those things often it's hard to pick up in the English because the word translating it maybe doesn't have the same double meaning that the Hebrew word does. And so sometimes it can be difficult to pick up on it, but it's an important aspect for us to think about. And it's one of the ways in which poetry functions in Scripture. Any questions or comments about any of that before we move forward? As we're kind of moving through here. If not, let's go ahead and move on to our next one. And that is chiasms. Does anybody know what a chiasm is? Yes.
The best way is like if you're like an A, B, B, A structure.
Yes.
Okay. I can't think of a better way to
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the idea is you have, it's a type of parallelism, but it's an ascending and descending parallelism. So you have A, B, C, C prime, B prime, A prime. And so your top lines parallel each other, the middle lines parallel each other, and then your very end lines parallel each other. And now it can be, I've done A, B, and C, it can be A and A, it can be A through E, or A through F. But where the author, in order to drive home a point, builds to here, has a parallel, and then comes back out. Now it can be as simple as in Matthew 23:12, we have a chiasm, and this one is a very simple one, just two lines. A is whoever exalts himself will be humbled. A prime is whoever humbles himself will be exalted. So a very simple chiasm, just two lines, but they're parallels to a degree. In this case, contrasting, but going back the other way, so ascending up and then coming back down. Now let's look at a more complex one, Amos 5:4. And you might want to look at this because it's not laid out as a chiasm in the language. And even though it's set apart as poetry, the chiasm isn't structured with as you're reading through it with the AB. I've got it up here with the different lines. But let's see, Amos 5:4-6. So this is kind of more in the middle. I think we skipped the first line and skipped the last line. But the chiasm begins here. So line A is, seek me and live. Line B is, but do not seek Bethel. Line C is, and do not enter into Gilgal or cross over to Beersheba. And so now let's think about C prime. So what's the next line after that? So what does the next line say? So which line is that parallel to?
C prime.
So C prime is parallel to C, and do not enter into Gilgal, and then C prime is for Gilgal shall go into exile. Now what's the next line? But that reflects right back up to, but do not seek Bethel. And then the last two lines, and seek the Lord and live, which parallels seek me and live. And so This is a chiasm, and they can be super simple. They can be really elaborate. This one's a really easy one to see. Some of them, you know, there's some passages you'll come to that some commentators will say this is a chiasm, and others will say, yeah, I don't quite see this being a chiasm. Some of them aren't quite as clear. But Scripture is, whether all the ones that people like to identify are or not, Scripture is full of chiasms, especially in poetry, and so it's a form of parallelism, but it's not. It's not consecutive lines that are parallel. So we actually have it can be just two lines in a row that are parallel. But often you'll see it like this. And the ABC is probably the most frequent structure. But like I said, you'll see ABCDEF and back out. But it is an important thing to think about, as basically what the author is doing is he's building up one side and then building back down the other side, and driving home a point. So with the in this one again, the what's the central point being made here? Yeah, paralleled with seek the Lord and live. Okay, so that's your main point. So now that's two different ways of saying in reality the same thing. Seek the Lord, seek me. It's the Lord writing, so it's the same thing. And it's driving home the point, seek the Lord. Now that's contrasted then with don't seek Bethel, for Bethel shall come to nothing. Don't seek Gilgal, for Gilgal shall go into exile. And so that's the contrast. And so we have this greater point being made of seek the Lord, don't seek Bethel, and then but then that's in contrast so we have those things set apart. So chiasm is an important thing to keep in mind. I don't, even in prose, but it comes up somewhat frequently. I don't necessarily take time every time I'm preaching and there's a chiasm to break down the chiasm for everybody. But you probably, some of you have maybe remember me at some point or another saying this is a chiasm and trying to explain it real quickly. Because there's a time that this structure becomes important in understanding the passage. There's other times when it's not as important, but it is something to keep in mind. It's one of the things that sets apart Hebrew poetry, and it is a helpful thing. And actually, I didn't even put the last line up here. But so any questions about chiasms? Okay, if not, let's go ahead and think about some guidelines, some things to think about when we come to poetry, some things to keep in mind as we go through. This is coming from Sterrett's book, these three things to think about. But I think they're good, helpful things to keep in mind. Analyze the line of each couplet to see how they are related to each other. And this is primarily when we're looking at parallelisms. But look at the lines. How do they relate to each other? Are they contrasting? Are they in parallel? Are they adding to each other? Look at the lines, see how they relate, and then through that we can begin to get a picture of the point that is trying to be made by them. Another important thing, look for figures of speech. We've spent, earlier in this study, we have spent time thinking about figures of speech, learning how to identify them, how to understand them. Again, since poetry is full of imagery, figures of speech are very, very important to understanding poetry. And so we have to spend time and we have to analyze what are the figures of speech. Go through, look at them, and analyze them. A third thing to do is, as we come to extreme, harsh, or violent language, consider that language, in light of the fact that poetry uses such language in a different way than prose does. And this is an important thing to keep in mind. Poetry and prose are different. And just as prophecy, which we'll look at next week, is different than poetry and prose. Now, there's some overlap. Poetry or prophecy employs both poetry and prose, but the very prophetic nature of it makes it a different genre. And so as we come to these things, it is important to keep them in mind and recognize that it does use language differently. And so when it's often when it's using extreme, harsh, or violent language, it is using it in this poetic form and needs to be understood in that. That doesn't mean it's not making a point. It doesn't mean that we just dismiss it because it's using it differently than prose. But it does mean we need to be careful in how we interpret it. And in looking at it, poetry is not a... straightforward statement an indicative thou shalt type statement. It is a more figurative language, more structured, helping us to illustrate, helping us to learn, and helping us to get a hold of principles, but doing it in a different thing. And so that is important for us to come together. I really probably should have started today with this point, and that is over the next couple of weeks we are going to be looking at the different genres. We've been looking at, as we've gone through the study so far, just more of the general ideas of general principles, how to figure out what words mean, how to figure out what imagery, typology, things like that. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at the different genres. Now, when we get in the second half of this study and start working on through understanding the Bible for all it's worth, that book really focuses on genre. And so it's going to be, each chapter is focused on the prophets or the narratives, things like that. So we'll spend a lot more time thinking through genre. But genre is important when we understand Scripture. And because if we try to read, as too many people do, read all of Scripture as if it's the same genre, we end up in a mess. And on the one hand, this should be straightforward to us, shouldn't it? You don't read, Treasure Island the same way you read the U.S. Constitution. I mean, we know that. That's straightforward. It's obvious. But we have to keep in mind with Scripture is not a single genre. I think the problem we make too many times, because it's a single book, we come to it with the idea that it's a single genre. And it's not. It is made up of several genres. And we need to keep that in mind. Poetry is a very significant one. But what are some of the others? I've already mentioned some of the others. But we've got a little bit of time left this morning, so I'm getting done with poetry a little quicker than I planned. But what are some of the genres? Epistles. What's that? Epistles. Historical. Narrative.
Prophecy.
prophecy,
apocalypse,
apocalyptic. These are some of the main ones. What else?
Gospel.
Let's break. Yeah, so the epistles, we can think about that as being a genre to a degree. It's a letter, so that's an important thing to keep about what it is. But even within the epistles, we can break those down into different genres.
Instructive. That
instructive.
Pastoral.
Maybe doctrinal.
Apologetic.
And so as we come to these different things, there are some overarching things like poetry, prose, prophecy, that are overarching genres, but there's also a lot even within those that can be broken down even more. And so it's important for us as we come to Scripture that we identify the type of genre we're in. Now, poetry is often, again, in our English translations, it's often easy to tell we're in poetry because we can't see the Greek or Hebrew. Sometimes it's hard to tell what the poetry is. And because a lot of times we can't pick up on the word plays, we can't pick up on things like that in the English. But we can, the translators usually set apart, let us know, hey, you're in poetry. They'll set it apart line by line and let us know that we are in a poetic section. But some of the other language is not always so easy. I think one of the problems that we've gotten into in the modern world, a lot of the modern bad exegesis of Revelation is how is Revelation generally interpreted today? What kind of genre is it looked at?
It's a lot of times looked at through prophecy.
It is prophecy.
Well, like more like as not so much seeing the metaphorical language that's being used. It's seen as very straightforward.
Very straightforward prose. Even though there's a recognition as prophecy, it's interpreted as prose, as straightforward prose. And the problem is it's not straightforward prose. It's poetic, apocalyptic imagery. And as such, it has to be interpreted as such. And so a lot of the problems that end up coming about, a lot of the problems we have in our world with eschatology really stem from the fact that we read Revelation as the wrong genre, and that gets us into a lot of trouble, and we could go on and on, and let's take another one. We're talking about poetry today. How is poetry, especially let's think about the book of Proverbs? How is Proverbs often read as law? But is Proverbs law? There's really two genres overlapping in Proverbs that are important. What are the two? It's poetry. We just mentioned that. What's the other?
Wisdom.
It's law and wisdom, or it's poetry and wisdom, but it's often read as law. And so again, we get ourselves in trouble because we're reading poetic wisdom language as prose law, and all of a sudden we're. All of a sudden, one of the things that was a family I used to work with, and they would quote all the time, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. And they would quote that as straightforward law and promise. If you do what you're supposed to do, your kids are going to do what they're going to do. And, of course, their kids didn't do what they were supposed to do, and it was a real consternation to them as they just kept waiting for their kids to come back, thinking, well, someday... my kids are going to get it all figured out because I did what I was supposed to do. But that's not law. That's not promise. It's general wisdom. It's, in general, yes, if we take time to train our children, they will grow up to do the right thing. It's really in contrast with the idea if we let our kids do whatever they want to do, it's going to be a mess. But it's not promise. It's not law. It is wisdom. And it's done in a poetic manner. And so we need to keep those things in mind. And so as we go through these genres, we're going to go brief overviews over the next few days, and then when we get into the next part of the study, as some of the other men get involved, they're going to be going through in more depth, looking at some of the different genres, really delving into the prophets, delving into the wisdom literature, the Psalms, the prophecy, and thinking through the way in which this language functions. Okay, got a couple minutes left. Any questions or comments before we're dismissed? Yes?
I just thought it'd be funny if God says, thou shalt not kill, but the proverb where it's like, if you be a man given to appetite, put a knife to your neck, basically.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. That's a really good point. And it's think about wisdom for a moment. Is that proverb saying go kill yourself if you're a glutton? No, it's poetic language. It's wisdom language. But what is it? It doesn't mean. Does that mean it doesn't have any meaning to it? No. What's it mean?
Stop being a glutton.
Stop being a glutton. You know, and it's serious. Okay. So what? There's a similar passage in the New Testament. You know, Christ says, you know, if you're given to lust, it's better to cut off your hand and poke out your eye. Now, on the one hand, I think it's right to point out that can we stop sinning by mutilating ourselves? No, we're not going to stop sinning by mutilating ourselves. But what's Christ's point?
Take it seriously.
Take it seriously. You should be willing to do whatever it takes, including cutting off your hand and poking out your eye, because it's more serious. It's, you know, what's the next phrase? It's better to go into heaven maimed than into hell whole. Now, ultimately, we know from Scripture that cutting off hands and poking out eyes is not going to solve our sin problem. But the point is driving home in a poetic way that there is a serious issue that has to be dealt with. And that we must be willing to take drastic measures in order to do that. And again, I'm not advocating, it's poetic. It's not saying go do this. It's saying what are you willing to do? And this, you know, again, with some of these things, you know, the question we need to ask ourselves, am I willing to do what it takes? Am I willing to fight sin that hard? And so often we're not.